welcome to the program. President Obama came to office with less experience than most of our contemporary presidents. His was an improbable and unlikely victory. Yet he inherited a country on the brink of depression, engaged in two wars, the ongoing threat of international terrorism, increased partisanship and gridlock and extremism, growing unemployment, and increased power for big business. And if that wasn't enough, his first big goal was to try and accomplish by expanding health care, something that had beguiled presidents since the days of Teddy Roosevelt. And all of this was in year one. We're going to talk about year one of the Obama presidency with my guest, Jonathan Alter. He's a senior editor at Newsweek. He's an analyst and contributing correspondent for NBC News. And his newest book is The Promise, President Obama, Year One. It is my pleasure to have Jonathan Alter back on this program. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Jeff. I'm glad to be here.
Good to have you here. One of the unique things about looking at year one of Obama is here's a guy that came to office we thought was an idea man, a great communicator in the tradition of Ronald Reagan, and we had great questions about his ability as an executive. In fact, he's turned out to be a pretty good executive and a pretty mediocre communicator. What's happened?
It's a great surprise, and that was one of the biggest surprises that I learned in researching and reporting The Promise. I think that what happened is that people kind of misunderstood what Obama considered to be really important. And he likes to give nice speeches, but what's really critical for him is really comes from sports. It's putting points on the board, getting things done. And so, you know, his whole focus has been to do what, you know, Mario Cuomo described. Cuomo said that politicians campaign in poetry and govern in prose. So once he arrived in the presidency, he thought that the public sort of cable TV parts of the job were of less consequence to him than what happened behind closed doors. And the decision-making process that would achieve certain results. And by the way, these problems were descending upon him fast and furious. And so I think that his kind of his disdain for the soundbite culture led him to neglect some of the communications efforts that he really needed, and he focused instead very intently on drilling down into problems, so to speak, to get as close as he could to the right answer.
And he also takes this philosophy, which grows out of his experience in Chicago, as you talk about, that somehow good governing, good government is good politics, that if you do the governing, the politics will take care of itself, and that would work out over the long run.
Yeah, I think that's right. The late Mayor Daley of Chicago, the father of the current mayor, said that good government was good politics, and I think Obama really believes that if he delivers for the American people, eventually they'll catch up and he'll get credit for it. And that his job, as he put it to me in an interview I did with him, was to get people and the Congress focused on these serious challenges, get us to be more serious. And he kind of thinks that the press is unserious. And he's right about that in a lot of ways. The problem is that you may recall during the healthcare debate, which I've got a lot about mm-hmm. in the Promise, he said essentially to liberals, don't make the perfect the enemy of the good. Deal with the world as it is, not as we want it to be, because we want to get something for healthcare. Politics is the art of the possible, so we're all going to have to compromise here. There aren't the votes for a public option and so forth. But when it comes to the media, he doesn't really take his own advice. He needs to deal with the superficial media world as it is, and maybe not so much as he wants it to be. And that would require him using more sound bites and more of the kind of theatrical elements of the presidency. When he said the other day that the presidency isn't a theater, I think he was wrong. It's always been a theater, and it always will be a theater. And we know that he can be gifted in inspiring people. He just needs to kind of connect more to that part of the job. He's worried about being inauthentic and being too much of an actor, because he thinks his ace in the hole politically is that he's he might not be more authentic than the average person, but that he's more authentic than the average politician. So he resists the pressure to be just another trained SEAL out there performing for the cable shows.
The other thing that you write about is this propensity to want his own timeline on issues, this sense that he doesn't want to respond to the 24/7 cable news cycle, that he wants to operate on his own time frame, his own timeline.
And that's absolutely right. You're picking up on a lot of the key themes, and you may remember that he felt that way when it came to the Iranian protesters in 2009, when it came to the underwear bomber on Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. And I think he's right. I mean, if you're president and you are trying to respond in the most thoughtful way possible, you want to try to do it on your terms, not on some cable news producer's terms. The problem is that the cumulative effect of this is to make it seem like he has slow political reflexes. We saw this with the BP oil spill. He was doing a lot behind the scenes early on. It's not like he was ignoring the crisis or anything, but he didn't convey to the American public early enough that he was on top of this, and that hurt him. That got him off to a slow political start. I think he can recover on that. And he's a very thoughtful, smart, methodical president. But it's not clear that, in this kind of slapdash age that really comes through. And I think he's had some trouble communicating with the American middle class that he's on their side and really understands some of what they're going through, even though he had many greater successes than many people realize in say preventing another Great Depression. I mean, we were headed for 1930s kinds of conditions. If we had stayed on the path we were on when Obama took office, we were losing 740,000 jobs a month in January of 2009. If we'd stayed on that pace, we would have been in another Great Depression by the end of 2009. No exaggeration. And they prevented that, did a lot of other things that we can talk about, and didn't get a lot of credit for it.
Well, and as you say, one of the differences between Obama and Roosevelt in that regard, who you've written about previously, is that there's a difference both in the politics and the optics between getting us out of something we're already in and preventing us from getting into something, which is what he did.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Roosevelt had a much grimmer economy, but he immediately reaped the political benefits of at least beginning to get us out of the Depression. Whereas for Obama, it was what the president described to me as a counterfactual, that unemployment did not go to 20%. That's an abstraction. So if the state stabilization fund that was part of the $787 billion American Recovery Act, if that prevents you from getting laid off, you don't really credit the president for that. Whereas if you had, been given a government job by Franklin Roosevelt, you would credit Roosevelt with that. And so it's been much harder for people to, appreciate what didn't happen, and what very much, might have happened. And even when, certain good things happened, Obama didn't get direct credit for it. For instance, the $700 billion in stimulus, $700 billion in TARP money, was paid back by the banks. Mm-hmm. And Obama said to me that, you know, he knew that these bank bailouts would be toxic, as he put it, political suicide. I think they were more surprised that the auto bailouts, which saved hundreds of thousands of jobs, that the public wouldn't be more appreciative of those. But it turns out people didn't like that either. You know, he got himself into a situation where he was, through no fault of his own, the hand that he was dealt, to, you know, mix a metaphor, was to just clean up after Bush. And I think that the oil spill is more of the same in this. This is a big theme of his early presidency, is what I call the shovel brigade. This was a line used by Don Regan, Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, you know, that the job of the president sometimes is to clean up after the elephants when they're leaving the circus, you know. And so Obama, on issue after issue, is cleaning up messes left by Bush's deregulatory policy on Wall Street, and now, in the Gulf, where if it hadn't been this disaster, it would have been something else when you put your energy policy in the hands of Ken Lay, literally,
right.
And you have your regulators literally, not figuratively, sleeping with the people that they're supposed to be regulating.
I want to come back to this idea of his political reflexes, because there's this one habit that seems to go back even to the Obama campaign and go right up through the whole BP crisis, and that is this sense of reacting late, of waiting until it's a little late to react, but having this incredible self-confidence that at that moment he can go out there, do the right thing, make the right speech, say the right thing, and turn the situation around.
Yes, he has that. He always thinks that he's going to hit the jump shot, the buzzer. And, you know, some of the people around him figure, hey, even Michael Jordan, you know, one of Obama's heroes, would sometimes miss the jump shot at the buzzer. But Obama doesn't seem to have any doubt that he can make it happen in the big moment, that he can rise to the occasion and eventually meet people's expectations. You know, in The Promise, I have scene after scene of him doing this, where he's working on the speech right up until the end. This was something Bill Clinton did as well, and sometimes not even reading the final version until he's on stage. Assuming that he can pull it out, letting the political situation at least deteriorate until the big moment, whether it's before Congress talking about health care or confronting the Republicans on health care and at Blair House, and then begin to use his personal charm to turn it around. And I think it's a bad habit. At a certain point, he needs to kind of move beyond that, or his presidency will be too much of a roller coaster politically for his own good. And we're already seeing that that play out. But this is, the good news is that when you pull back the curtain and look at the way he operates, when that door to the Situation Room closes or the Oval Office closes, and this is really what I was after in The Promise, he's a tremendously thoughtful, decisive, and quite effective chief executive.
You talk about it in the context of this habit of command, and one of the most telling examples of that is the story of him dressing down Admiral Mike Mullen. Tell that story.
Yeah. You might remember that in the fall of last year, they had these 20 hours of review of the what they call the AFPAC policy, the Afghanistan-Pakistan policy. And before they had made a determination on what the policy was going to be, you had General McChrystal, who was out, he was on 60 Minutes and a cover of magazines. He was basically saying we need an open-ended 10-year counterinsurgency commitment, cost, $1 trillion or whatever, in order to turn the situation around. in Afghanistan, and they hadn't yet decided that this was the right thing to do. And Joe Biden had a much more restricted plan with few troops, used Predator drones, and so the White House makes it pretty clear they think that they don't want the Pentagon trying to box the president in. And General McChrystal goes to London, and in a speech afterward, he says, in the Q&A, he says that he's asked whether he could support the Biden plan, basically. And he says, in a word, no. And in the White House, they're just furious about this. You know, the commanding general is saying that if the president sides with the vice president, he can't support the policy. That's insubordination. So Obama is over in Copenhagen trying and failing to get the Olympics for Chicago, and he meets with McChrystal on the tarmac. You might remember the picture. He's on Air Force One, and he decides that it's not McChrystal's fault, that he's a good soldier, but that it is the fault of his superiors who gave him the green light to do this. So when he gets back to Washington, he hauls Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, into the Oval Office, and he tells him that he is, quote, exceedingly unhappy with his conduct, that he wants to know here and now that this behavior will change, that it's doing a disservice to our men and women in uniform. And I was told at the time that it was the most direct confrontation between the president and the military since Truman fired MacArthur in 1951, and I found that a little hard to believe, but when I researched it, it turned out to be true. Obama pushed back and pushed back hard at being manipulated by the Pentagon, and Mullen left the meeting chagrined, he and General and Secretary Gates, who was at the meeting, and General Petraeus all gave speeches where they said that a commander's advice to the president should be confidential and that they should not try to make their case in public. When I asked the president, were you jammed by the Pentagon? He answered, quote, I neither confirm nor deny that I was jammed by the Pentagon, which is, you know what that means, right? So, you know, the effect of this was that he ended up with a policy that wasn't what McChrystal and Hillary Clinton and those in the Pentagon wanted. It was a quick in, quick out escalation, and with the pledge to begin to withdraw next year. Now we'll see whether that happens. I have my doubts about the policy and whether it's certainly not working right now, whether it will work over time. But what I found fascinating, was to, kind of restrain myself from speculating too much on what would happen in the future, and instead try to tell readers what did happen. How did this decision to send what's now 100,000 troops to Afghanistan and pursue this quick-in, quick-out policy, which also required a kind of a confrontation with General Petraeus inside the Situation Room, how did that play out? So I really, did manage to kind of get fly on the wall stuff for people who are interested in the way presidential decisions are really made.
And with respect to Obama and those decisions, you talk over and over again about his appreciation for deductive reasoning, this idea that there is always a right answer if you can drill down deep enough.
Yeah, or at least the least bad answer, the least wrong answer. I think that's a danger. And that there might be a danger that he relies too much on experts. He's surrounded by a lot of folks I call policy mandarins. they may be a little too educated for their own good, for the president's good. I'm rather hard on Obama on restricting the circle of economic advisors. I think he should have used his leverage over the banks when he had it in early 2009. And that the bill we're getting now is better than nothing, but not what it should be. I favored breaking up the banks. And I think that this sense that he can solve every problem if he just considers it methodically enough is misleading. But having said that, You know, I have a chapter called The Un-Bubba, where I compare him to Bill Clinton, and mostly pretty favorably. Clinton is an inductive, horizontal thinker with a connective intelligence that can yield some creative solutions that maybe a deductive, vertical intelligence like Obama's might not. But when you're in a series of crises, and these were, Jeff, these were really historic. They are really historic times that we're going through. The deductive thinking, which leads to logical, crisp decision-making and analytical rigor, really has its advantages, especially if it's married to what I call the Zen temperament that he has, that, you know, prevents ego issues from interfering in his work relationships, and gives him an ability to multitask that's rather impressive. You know, the difference between Obama's even tempered quality and Bill Clinton's explosive temper is really stark. Now, there's some advantages for people who, at least when Clinton would calm down and, you know, he'd say, you know, "I love you, man," or whatever he would say to kind of tell people that they were back in his good graces. With Obama, it's kind of a constant 60 degrees all the time. It's not exactly cold or chilly, but you're never quite sure where you stand with him. And he doesn't say thank you as much as he could. But generally, the people who've worked for both Clinton and Obama, most of them prefer working for Obama because he's not, they used to call Clinton the second guesser in chief, and that was terribly frustrating for staff.
Right. But not having that or as strong a connective intelligence has not served him well in certain areas. And part of that comes from not being, as you write about in The Promise, that kind of traditional needy politician.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. God, Jeff, you're really getting at a lot of the themes here. You know, mostly I'm trying to give people more information on which to make own judgments about Barack Obama and his presidency. But there are these themes, and by not being a needy guy himself, which is very unusual for politicians, most of them are just terribly needy individuals. And, you know, that's a good thing in a lot of ways. But it also means that he's not as in tune with the neediness of other people, whether it's the neediness of members of Congress or the neediness of the American people to, you know, be reassured immediately after the Christmas Day bomber, you know, is foiled, or the other kinds of neediness that's just a part of politics. So for him to stroke congressmen, for instance, he does it well. He's very assiduous about doing it in order to achieve his objectives. But it's learned behavior. It's not as natural as it might be for a Bill Clinton or for another politician. Now, he compensates for that by being more disciplined than Clinton. And so he'll make, you know, Clinton sometimes neglected the stroking chores with Congress. And look, on something like health care or, you know, the stimulus, Clinton tried and failed to get a $16 billion stimulus through. Obama, admittedly in different economic times, got a $787 billion stimulus through that achieved all kinds of progressive objectives with people not even really knowing it. It went through so fast. And of course, on health care, you know, Clinton's plan failed and Obama won ugly, but he did win, and it's the most sweeping piece of social legislation since 1965. So, you know, notwithstanding the fact that he is neglecting, he's missing some of these conventional tools of a politician, he's pretty gifted in his own way, and he finds other ways to bring people around. Now, having said that, he made a number of tactical mistakes in the healthcare debate and in other areas that we can talk about. But you know, I found that in a lot of areas there were there were more successes than I think any of us really realized at the time in 2009.
Is there the danger, does he have the danger, in spite of all of this, of taking on too much? I mean, he says that, you know, he wasn't sent there in kind of a swipe to Bill Clinton. He wasn't sent there to deal with school uniforms. On the other hand, when one looks at the accomplishments of year one, health care, the stimulus bill, which is a gigantic, as you talk about, a gigantic undertaking of its own, and the international side of this, there is this argument that maybe there's too much, plus the crises like the Gulf that just happen to come along.
Well, a lot of what happens to any president, they have no control over it. You know, what happens to come up. And, you know, at one point Obama said to me, look, he likes to say, look, guys, to his people, you know, look, when an H1N1 pandemic is, you know, number six or seven on the list of things you have to deal with, you know, you've got a full plate, you know. So some of this was just what he was dealt by history. And you know, he was forced to multitask. The big question came up, you know, should he have undertaken health care in year one? And pretty much all the people around him said no. Joe Biden said, look, you only promised to do this by the end of your first 4 years. The American people will give you a break, pass on this because of the economy. Rahm Emanuel told me, quote, I begged the president not to do this. David Axelrod thought they should do energy first. Christina Romer, the chairwoman of the Council of Economic Advisers, reminded Obama that Franklin Roosevelt waited 2 years after he came into office before he introduced Social Security, his landmark domestic legislation. So I asked the president, why'd you do it? And he said, well, I told Nancy Pelosi that I'd go down 10 to 15 points in the polls, and indeed he did, and that I might jeopardize my chances of reelection. So I repeated the question, why'd you do it? And he said, if we didn't do it now, it wouldn't have happened. And in that, I think, was historically right, that, you know, people can complain that healthcare does this, doesn't do that, but it got done. It's going to ensure 31 million more Americans. And if he had waited and said, oh, my plate's too full, I can't do this now, he would have lost his political capital. He would have had fewer Democrats in Congress, and we'd still be waiting for health care as we have for the last 75 years.
You talk about his ability to self-correct. In year one, in the promise, what are the areas that he has self-corrected on, and has his staff served him well in that, and is that an area that he needs to correct as he moves into the other years of his presidency?
Well, I think he self-corrected somewhat on the banks, not enough for my tastes, but for instance, you know, I've got a lot in the book about Paul Volcker, who, mm-hmm. and this was a real revelation, you know, he turned out to be the populist of the bunch, right? You know, he thinks banks are too big and that they need to prevent financial institutions that are engaging in what's called proprietary trading in their own accounts from, you know, from being backed by the government. It's like he thinks the government shouldn't back casinos, basically. And at first, Obama rebuffed him. Larry Summers, the former president of Harvard and Treasury Secretary, has really restricted the access to Obama on the economy, and I'm rather hard on that in the book. But by the end of the year, Obama recognized that had been a mistake, and he brought Volcker in, and he embraced the so-called Volcker rule, which would separate trading from banking. Not a full restoration of the Depression-era Glass-Steagall bill that was repealed under Clinton, but the beginning of a more sensible regulatory approach when it came to Wall Street. So I think that he self-corrected some there. I think you're seeing him self-correct on some of these slow reflexes where he's, you know, he recognizes that when he does respond, he has to do it in a more forceful way and not have people just assume that he's going to make the right decision, and he needs to show as well as tell. And you saw that in the more forceful tone of his speech the other night. But I think even there, he still hasn't self-corrected when it comes to sound bites. You know, he disdains them. And I think he forgets that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, is a sound bite, or, you know, Abraham Lincoln's "A House Divided Against Itself Cannot Stand" is a sound bite. And he needs to make more concessions to the communications demands of our age, or really any age. I mean, basically, most great historic figures have encapsulated their thoughts better than Barack Obama is right now. So I think if there's one area for him to really adjust and self-correct more, it's in this way of, you know, ironically, given his reputation as an orator, in this area of speaking more cogently and memorably, and leaving people with a metaphor or a soundbite, if you will, that sticks in the minds, that lingers with people and allows him to frame the issues to his benefit. Because I think part of what's happened is Republicans have just done a better job of what's called framing. Now, as Al Franken points out, it's easier for them in some ways because their bumper sticker has one word on it, no. And the Democrats' bumper sticker, as Franken says, has a whole bunch of words on it with continued on the next bumper sticker.
And finally, even with the self-correcting, there is a sense of him having this incredible faith in his own decisions and his own ability, the very improbability of his election as president,
yeah,
and his ability to pull that off gives him that faith.
Yeah, you know, there's a story, and I really do try to take people, you know, out onto the basketball court or the patio or the Rose Garden, wherever the president is, and get a sense of the kinds of things that he's saying. And at one point, because Obama had kept some lucky charms in his pocket that he'd been given by voters during the campaign, you know, he would tell his folks that he was lucky. And so when the polls really went south on health care in the late summer of 2009, Rahm Emanuel said, you know, "He's still feeling lucky, Mr. President." And Obama said, "Hey, my name is Barack Hussein Obama, and I'm sitting right here, so hell yeah, I'm feeling lucky." And I think that, you know, partly summarizes the attitude. And then at another point, he said to an old friend from Harvard Law School who asked if he was going to run for re-election, he said, "You know, I don't know why anybody would want this job for more than one term, you know, but I'll be damned if I'm going to leave all the good stuff to Mitt Romney after all the crap we've been through." And I think that kind of summarized his attitude, that he believes in what he calls a philosophy of persistence. And he's going to hang in there. He's going to run for re-election. And I think it would be a mistake to underestimate Barack Obama.
Jonathan Alter, the book is The Promise, President Obama, Year One, just out from Simon & Schuster. Jonathan, it's always a pleasure. I thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeff. I enjoyed it.